So I'm going to talk about sustainable cities and in the context of climate change to some extent. Already more than half the global population live in cities, which means that more than half the population live on 1% of the landmass. So we're crowded together, and we're going to become even more crowded together by 2050. It's estimated that something like 3/4 of us will live in cities. And already, the impacts of climate change on cities and other areas is significant. It's currently estimated that something like over $1 trillion annually is the cost of climate change. And so it's a major economic as well as social and environmental problem. And this is probably a facetious question. Why do we need sustainable cities? I've just explained that we're all going to be living in them, and we have to figure out a way that our cities are sustainable. And the way that we're moving, if you look at modern cities today, the tendency is to enclose ourselves in buildings, to shut the buildings off from the outside, and to live in this environment that we manufacture for ourselves, completely devoid of interaction with the external environment around us. And that's completely unsustainable because it means that there's a huge energy cost in this whole process. That is just something that we cannot afford, both in terms of economic activity, but also, more importantly, in terms of the emissions that that produces, which, of course, creates more inhospitable conditions in the external environment, and we close ourselves off even more and use even more energy and make the system worse and worse. And so we need to find a way of breaking this vicious cycle and moving away and living much more holistically in the city environment. So we need to use green and blue spaces, parks, open water, alongside the built environment in order to live comfortable, healthy lives. In our cities, we need to climate-proof our cities, provide buffers against extreme weather, and use the natural environment along with engineered solutions to find a way of living comfortably together. We know, for example, that urban green helps us both in terms of cleaning the atmosphere, provides shade, and other very beneficial aspects. Healthy people like to exercise in green places. We're so lucky living in Cambridge. I can't believe how much green area there is around us, and I think we take it for granted. Many other places, it's much more difficult to experience that. Using urban wetland, permeable surfaces, for example, to provide flood resilience. So here's an example of how these effects might work. This is London, and these are land surface temperatures in London in the summer. The black line, as you'll recognize, is the M25, and you can clearly see the Thames. And I'll just point out these two areas. Inner London, the top arrow, the land surface and the west end, the temperature is 31 degrees. Richmond Park down here to the southwest, the surface temperature is 23 degrees. So the role of green spaces in these areas can be dramatic. If you fix your eyes on this picture and look at where the greeny yellow bits are, and I'll switch to the next picture, which shows you where the parklands are in London. And I'll go back and forth a couple of times to try and convince you that there's a very strong correlation between the cooler parts of the city and the greener parts of the city. So what I've tried to show you in these brief pictures is that the green and blue parts of cities, I think, are a very important ingredient in this whole process. And what I was going to go on and show you is how you can design buildings to take advantage of the natural environment when the natural environment is benign. And in particular, I was going to show you some examples of buildings which are not air-conditioned that work very well in the city environment. Let me try and explain what the problem is in terms of how buildings work. So if you're a single person and you sit in an office of a reasonable size and you ask, how much air do I need in order to just to breathe and not to have a buildup of carbon dioxide? And you say, that's the amount of air that I want to exchange between inside and outside. And then you imagine that this office is a perfectly insulated box, so no heat can leave or enter through the walls of this office. Then you give off enough heat to keep yourself warm. You give off about 100 watts. I give off certainly more than 100 watts now because I'm stressed. You give off rather less than 100 watts because you're not. You may be frustrated, but not stressed. And that's enough to give you a 10 degree difference between inside and outside at that sort of flow rate. So if it's winter, and it's 10 degrees outside, then just your body heat in an office will keep it at 20 degrees. And that's fine. Now reverse it to the summer and imagine that it's now 20 degrees outside. And you're still giving off this extra 10, your office is still 10 degrees hotter than outside. Now it's not acceptable. It's 30 degrees inside. And so you need to generate an additional flow through the building in order to reduce that temperature difference. And so a major challenge in buildings is to keep them cool. Even in the UK, that the major energy that we use in buildings is really in certainly in the non-domestic sector, I won't say in houses, but in non-domestic sector is keeping buildings cool and not heating them. Keeping buildings warm is easy. You just insulate them well and build them properly so they're tight. But cooling buildings is a real challenge. Ah, we have some progress. Yeah? Good. Thank you. Okay. All right. How long do I have?
As much as you need.
Okay. So I'm going to go and show you. I won't throw all these pretty pictures anymore. So this is the problem. If you look at the carbon consumption, a million tons of carbon equivalent emissions from these various sectors, you can see that over the last 50 years, buildings have increased a lot. This is, of course, partly because the building stock has increased a lot. And as I was saying, the main problem is that in places we build greenhouses, we build glass boxes, they heat up with the sun, and we generate greenhouse gases from them. So that's what we do, and typically, and it's very, very bad. And in fact, not only that, people don't like them. If you take surveys of buildings, typically most people who work in modern office buildings don't enjoy the environment. And this goes back to the first air-conditioned building, which was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright in about 1920, just after the invention of air conditioning. And you can see that it's quite different from the buildings that we currently build in places like Hong Kong and in London and elsewhere, right? So this is much more a traditional building with small windows, hardly any glass, and so forth. That's how it started out. And of course, engineers realized that if you can air condition a building like this, you don't need to build them with brick, thick walls and so forth and small windows, and you can go to the modern design. And that's what causes all the energy problems with modern buildings. And this is what I was going to explain to you. So the heating problem, as I said, is a trivial problem. You don't need much airflow to keep yourself, if you just want air to breathe and it keeps you warm. But in the summer, the problem is reversed and it becomes unbearably hot inside and you should provide extra flow. And the way we do that is to use the heat that's given off inside buildings, either from occupants or from equipment or whatever, to drive the flow through the system. And there are two ways to do it. One is to allow the air to stratify, which is you allow the hot air that rises from all of you to accumulate at the ceiling and to extract it from the ceiling, as on the left, or you provide a mechanism to mix that around so that everywhere the temperature is roughly uniform. And you can see that for a given flow rate, for a given amount of ventilation through the system, because the air leaving on the left is much hotter than the air leaving on the right, you get out much more heat in that context than you do when it's on the other side. And as I said, this would be a movie showing you how that works, but I'm not going to do that, but you can generate these displacement systems or mixing systems in this way. And this is the kind of buildings that we're now building, which are using that principle. So this is a building in Leicester. It was the Green Building of the Year in 1995, designed by Alan Short, who's Professor of Architecture here. And you can see that it looks much more like the Frank Lloyd Wright building than it does the modern Gherkin and Shard and other buildings that we build currently. So it goes back to using relatively small windows. And these tall towers, these tall ventilation towers, very reminiscent of wind towers that were in Iran well over 1,000 years ago. Many of the same principles, and they simply are chimneys that allow the hot air to rise and to provide the ventilation flow that you need to keep yourself cool. So it's perfectly possible to develop now buildings that are not air conditioned, that are not sealed from the outside, and that provide excellent conditions inside. And this is done through a series of modeling processes, so we can build models of these in the laboratory and test them, make predictions of their performance, and use that then to optimize the design of the building, which is what was done for that building. Here's another example that's close to my heart. I always like to work on breweries, if possible. So this is a brewery in Malta, and you can see it has very similar properties, these towers at the top, and that's the same idea of letting this hot air out at the top. And this is the way the system works, with air coming in around the periphery of the building and leaving from the top. And when the temperature outside fluctuates from 20 degrees to 37 degrees day to night, the temperature in the process hall in the side there fluctuates by less than 1 degree C over the day. So you can get incredibly good control of these buildings using natural systems, even in climates that one would think are very inhospitable. Okay, so I'm very pleased that Richard talked about magical thinking. So I'm going to tell you now about a new project that we're just undertaking, which I think fits in very well into this whole theme. So earlier in about a year ago, the Engineering and Physical Sciences Research Council issued a grand challenge for sustainability of future cities. And as I was saying earlier in my presentation, they were very interested in getting a balance between both engineered and natural systems. And so we are now engaged in this project, MAGIC, which is an acronym for Managing Air for Green Inner Cities. And I'm going to tell you just a little bit about what our ambitions are for this project. It's a collaborative project between Cambridge, Imperial College London, and the University of Surrey. And it's a very interdisciplinary project. So within Cambridge, it involves seven departments across engineering, science, social sciences, and three departments at Imperial, and so on. So a very complicated and interesting interdisciplinary project. And in addition, we have a number of very interesting industrial partners working alongside us for this goal. So I hope you'll recognize some of these names here. Arup, one of the major engineering companies in this country, a global industry, of course, but initially set up in London. Dyson, who are famous for vacuum cleaners, and you may wonder what vacuum cleaners have got to do with sustainable cities. Well, they're very interested in the internal environment. How do you make the internal environment comfortable using their various devices? Architects like Fosters and Partners, and so on. So this is a big consortium. And it's a five-year program, which just began in December. So our grand challenge is to produce a city with no air pollution and no heat island by 2050. I didn't put that bit in, but by 2050, right? So this is obviously a very, it's an unattainable goal, but our reason for stating it in such bold terms is that we think that actually we need to break, as I said before, that vicious cycle of living in glass boxes and sealing ourselves off from the outside world. So we need to create cities where the air pollution is very, very low so people can live healthy lives, and where the heat impacts of the buildings is very small so that the air is suitable for bringing inside to buildings and for you to breathe and feel comfortable with. So it's quite a big program. We have 30 person years of postdoc time devoted over this five-year project. And we chose this as our goal because, first of all, air quality is a really important issue. Air pollution is a really important issue, both from health points of view and economically. It's responsible in the UK for something in the region of 40,000 premature deaths a year. And economic estimates vary between 10 and 20 billion pounds per annum just within the UK. So it's a very important economic and social problem. And also we feel that you kind of think of cities as being clean or dirty depending on whether they're polluted from an air perspective or not. It's a very nice marker of whether a city is sustainable or not. And the other great thing about air is we all share it, so it's kind of universal to all of us, and we can measure it. We can measure the pollutants very accurately. It's a very nice marker for whether a city is moving in the right direction for sustainability or not. So what we're going to produce is a completely new tool for urban planners and regulatory authorities. And it will be used across the range of scales, from emergency response, so very rapid operational managements, to long planning, long time planning. And we're going to do this using the latest in computational techniques and adaptive observational technologies. So we're going to have a system which will allow, for example, traveling monitors to travel around the city and monitor things. Eventually, we believe this will be on completely autonomous vehicles that will travel around, will estimate how much pollution you're likely to receive, give you information about where you should move and not move within the city if you want to reduce your exposure. And as I said before, we want a system that harmonizes the built and natural environment and provide estimates both for health and social and carbon costs and the impacts of climate change. So, as I said, we're interested across this big range, and this is a huge issue from emergency response, what happens if there is some pollution event or even a terrorist attack releasing some toxic material into the atmosphere, through planning over days and months. As many of you will know, when the Olympics were hosted in Beijing in 2008, the economy of Beijing was basically suspended for a month at a huge economic cost in order that the bird's nest didn't look like that. And I've already shown you the building on the right. So this is so you allow for how buildings will evolve over the lifetime of a building like this, which lasts for decades. So we have a very big ambition to work across this whole range of time and spatial scales. And our components for this are essentially focused around, as I said, a computational model. So I'm an applied mathematician, so we like to calculate numbers. And we're going to use that information to make predictions about how the system works as a whole. And we'll feed this into an economic model that will allow a management and decision support system to be made. So, for example, we would like to be in a position at the end of this project to say that if you take this piece of land and convert it from a set of apartments to a park, this will be the benefit in terms of this will be the changes in air pollution, this will be the changes in the health of the people who live around this area, and what are the costs? And there'll be that'll be the kind of long-term planning we would like to be able to promote so that we can develop plans for our cities in the long term. Oh, my movie does work, amazing. At least one of them works. Okay, and so this is the computational, an example of the kind of computational model that we can do these days. And this shows a pollutant being released amongst a group of buildings, blocks. And we're able nowadays to make incredibly close, careful predictions of the concentration level of these pollutants using the latest computational models. So this is the major technical advance that we can use here to improve the accuracy of these systems. And I don't think the wind tunnel movie will work. Maybe it will. No. Okay. All right. Okay. And we're also, as I said, going to have a cost-benefit model. This will provide links between the planning and the costs. We'll incorporate social costs, costs of carbon, and some macroeconomics. So it's meant to be feeding in the physics and the chemistry of this process into the social aspects so that we can impact on the well-being of people living in cities. We'll be focusing in particular on a case study. We haven't quite decided where yet, but we may well choose a new development that Imperial is building in the west of London. This gives you some idea of the kind of capabilities nowadays of visualization. So this is a real person standing here. And so we're able to visualize these flows and their impacts right down to very small scales. Okay, so what I want to say finally is that, and I'm sorry this has been a bit disjointed, but that I think sustainable cities are critical for our future. We're certainly going to live in cities, and they certainly have to be sustainable. And I think the way to approach this is through a holistic merging of the built and the natural environment. Goodness me, sorry. How did that happen? Okay, get my whole talk again. Okay. And our aim, eventually, is to increase the health and well-being of people and preserve nature. Okay. Well, I'm sorry that was kind of disjointed, but thank you very much for listening.